from McCain Auditorium at Kansas State University, KPR presents An Hour with the President of Costa Rica, Luis Guillermo Solis. President Solis was elected in 2014. He is a historian and professor by training, has published more than 10 books, and was a Fulbright Scholar at the University of Michigan. He's actually the second president of Costa Rica to give a Landon Lecture at Kansas State University. The first, Oscar Arias Sanchez, spoke at K-State in 1987. President Solis gave this Landon Lecture on May 19, 2016.
Good afternoon to all. Thank you very much, Madam Provost, Honorable Ambassador Roman Macaya, Honorable Consul Castro, professors, students, ladies and gentlemen, friends. First of all, allow me to express my gratitude to this great university for inviting me to share with you some thoughts on state governance and security in Central America. It is indeed a great pleasure for me, but it is also a true honor for the Costa Rican president to be here, having been preceded by 171 orators is something that I do treasure very much. And the fact that you're here, even this afternoon, a rainy afternoon in Manhattan, having the pleasure of seeing Senator Casebaum among the audience, and knowing that all of you took your time to come and hear what I can share with you this afternoon is something that I treasure very much, and I want to appreciate greatly all the efforts that you took to bring me here, to keep me well, and to come and share with me these thoughts. I think what I'm going to say is shared by most. I'm not going to say too many new things for you all. You know, some of the principles and values that we treasure very much. Principles and treasures that we treasure because they are intrinsic to democratic development. And I refer primarily to defense of human rights, the preservation and promotion of the rule of law, the construction of societies that put in front of anything else the needs and the well-being of people at this core, at the center of public policy, disarmament, demilitarization as superior objectives, like in the search for peace among nations, and the respect for the environment and its sustainable use are as factors that are determinant for the survival of our species. In that sense, I'm very pleased to be able to talk about some of the problems we're facing in a small region of the world, Central America, so small that altogether these seven nations of Central America form a continental mass no larger than Texas, but that's still very important in terms of the place where it's located, and as a bridge between the northern hemisphere, the southern hemisphere, between the Pacific Ocean and the Caribbean Sea. Well, you've heard I've been a professor for over 35 years. I'm a historian originally, and then I studied political science. And when one's a professor for so long, at a lecture like this, I necessarily have to talk about theory a little bit. I'm not going to go on for too long, but allow me to say a couple of things about the theory of the state that I used to talk with my students. Every time we talked about security and how important it is for societies these days, it's a common question that we face all the time. We forget that we have to put that in a broader context, and that broader context has to do with the notion of security and the role the state plays in society and its significance, especially the relationship among states and their relationship with globalization and the challenges of security that they confront. And these challenges we know well, among others, the displacement of human populations, largely migrations, the growth of organized crime, particularly narco-trafficking, but not only narco-trafficking, we're also talking about smuggling of people. We're talking about cultural goods. We're talking about our environmental goods that are being trafficked everywhere. We're talking about climate change, pandemics, and other similar phenomena, which require the cooperation among states. These are all problems that we cannot solve by ourselves individually. So there's a whole new meaning to the word cooperation in this world of ours. And in all societies, this is the case. This is not a question of the East or the West. It's something that we have to face everywhere in the world. But allow me to talk a little bit about the state and the role it has played in the structuring of power relations in the Western societies. Not that it didn't happen elsewhere, but I find that it is important to at least refer to the experience of the Atlantic West, those relations as portrayed in the development of the state in Europe and in Latin America, the United States, and this side of the world. If you recall, in 1651, Thomas Hobbes talked about the state and he called it a Leviathan, a mythological monster. And among the most important characteristics of that Leviathan, he talked about its role, its fundamental role in guaranteeing the social pact by ensuring that this state was going to be able to exercise monopolistically, in other words, by in and on itself, the use of force as the basis of security. Security for the state in itself, and the security of the people that lived under the rule of that state. And that notion that the state was the only one who could control the use of power to ensure security very soon became the raison d'être, the reason of the existence of the state. And this brought about a certain notion that we could summarize by saying the leitmotif of this Leviathan was that we were going to give that Leviathan absolute power so that he could give us back, it could give us back absolute security. And this was a notion that prevailed in the West for, you know, at least 200 years. In 1795, Immanuel Kant published his famous book on perpetual peace. And in doing so, he started talking about the need to control the Leviathan. He felt that we had to put some limits to the Leviathan, that we couldn't simply agree that this Leviathan was going to rule us and impose on us its will. And he said, and this both in the internal sense and in an international sense, he is the originator of what is going to be later considered to be contemporary multilateralism. And he basically said, okay, there are a few things we can do to prevent the Leviathan eating us all up. He talked about the elimination of war and the threat of use of force among nations. He talked about the adoption of rules that had to be admitted by all states and that should be enforced by a superior organization on all states. And he also talked about the control of armies and the elimination of secret alliances, among other things. And in doing so, he proposed the basis of what was going to become later an international order ruled by the Society of Nations first, and then the United Nations, of course. But the defeat of Napoleon, well, the appearance of Napoleon Bonaparte first, and then his defeat in 1815, and the Conference of Vienna, brought about the idea that the international community, foreign by states, had to put limits to those states that didn't behave well. And fundamentally to prevent the appearance of a new Napoleon. So the Conference of Vienna, which actually created the first international system as we know it in the West, was a return to the old idea of the Leviathan, although in this case, in talking about the concert of Europe, the Leviathan was going to have several heads, all of which were going to try to contain the threatening presence of one superpower. Now, whatever we can think about Napoleon and the Concert of Nations and the Conference of Vienna and all of that, the truth of the matter is that up until the First World War, that concept of a concert of nations, of an equilibrium amongst several countries to prevent the rise of one, was dominant in all in the West. And furthermore, it brought about the question of the state being the main actor in international affairs and in providing the security for its citizens. Now, this changed. And during the Second World War and after the Second World War, we have the appearance of the United Nations after the failure of the League of Nations, the Society of Nations, as it was also called. And what happened was that the appearance of nuclear power as a decisive new weapon with the capacity to destroy humanity made the world feel that somehow we had to go back to the old Kantian idea of an international control on individual states. And even when the international order, as ruled by the United Nations, remained controlled by the five permanent members of the Security Council, all of which had nuclear capacity, the truth of the matter is that from a legal point of view, from the development of instruments of international law, the world was able to bring forth this idea that there were certain principles that had to be imposed on all the world, regardless of if the countries were big and small. One very important piece of that, generated by Eleanor Roosevelt, among others, was the Human Rights Charter, which was agreed upon the nations of the world as the basis upon which the future of peace had to be built upon. Fortunately, that concept has continued to develop. Obviously, the end of the Cold War brought about a new situation in which it was clear that the idea of the emerging threats of the world, again, had to be put in a multilateral framework. It was not the issue of big powers dominating the world, a single power dominating the world, even when we had that significant debate on the end of history, you know, and Fukuyama and all of that, that democracy was going to prevail everywhere. Even when that did happen, the growing sensation in the world, and then the reality of international relations, particularly with the breaking about of Eastern Europe and the end of the Soviet reign in Eastern Europe, etc., meant that, you know, the multilateral vision prevailed. And this latter modernity, as Habermas called it, became an idea that built up on this notion of an open multilateralism that was so different from that paradigm that Hobbes proposed in the mid-17th century. And today, this idea of multilateralism and globalization has even grown more, furthered by info-telecommunications, by the use of technology, and due to the fact that we are now challenged by threats that were unknown before. Not unknown in the sense that they were not present. I mean, we've had terrorism for thousands of years, but threats that are now capable of destroying societies throughout the world in real time. And this is also the case with natural disasters. So one of the principal characteristics is that globalization brought about in terms of its relations with the state is that the fact that now the peoples of the world, not only the states, are present in decision making. And this has made some of the old notions that we used to use very complex. For many, many years, it was easy to talk about borders as a definitive measure of national sovereignty. It was very easy to talk about sovereignty in and on itself, the capacity of a state to develop and to exert control over its own institutions, territory, and peoples. Nowadays, some of the challenges I face as a president every day are solved not within Costa Rican borders, but in Brussels, or in New York, and in Washington, or in the World Trade Organization. So the concept of what I can do as a sovereign nation is limited. It's at least moderated by these new conditions of the global economy. It is also more difficult to talk about a nation. Look at the difficulties Spain has had. A country formed by several nations. Or Italy, the north and the south divided by nationalistic issues. Or what happened in the former Yugoslavia. Or what we see in Iraq. So it's not easy to talk about a nation anymore. How national is a multinational nation formed with, you know, by hundreds of different peoples coming from different places, particularly at this time of great human migrations? So that's not easy to deal with anymore. So it is a case of non-intervention. We used to talk about non-intervention as a definitive principle of international law. It's very easy to say, we are in favor of no intervention. And then the Canadians started talking about the right to intervene. What happens if the international community is faced with a massive violation of human rights and destruction of human life? Does the international community, following Chapter 7 of the Charter of the United Nations, has the right, or some say the obligation, to intervene? Nowadays, that's even questioning. So, you know, the old concepts are difficult to deal with these days, and they have become void. This complexity have made the challenges of war and peace to become more complex, more difficult to deal with, and obviously have brought up new tensions, new forms of conflictivity that are not the same than the ones we had in the old order of nation states. And so there's a very fundamental and even contradictory reality these days. You know, the old nation state has to live side by side with these new realities, with these new complicating circumstances, with peoples that are not tolerating the behavior of these states anymore. The Arab Spring is probably a very good example of what I mean. You know, populations that say no more, we're not going to take it anymore. And that's an old concept, clearly. I mean, we see it in the French Revolution in 1789. That's what that revolution was all about. Inspired in your own War of Independence in 1776. But it now has a different meaning because of the conditions of the world, of the geopolitics of the world, and it also has a different meaning because of the use of technology and the spread of ideas, again, in real time. So it's now, we have to deal with these new circumstances. The capacity to decide has gone away from the Leviathan. And some people talked about post-modernity to refer to all these changes that took place after the end of the Cold War. But it is clearly a situation that reflects a new attitude on people and also means the resurging of what some French historians like Renouvin have called the les forces profondes, the deeper forces of history, religion, nationalism, the language of nations, which are now taking precedence over some of those very hardly defined, clearly defined concepts that I mentioned. And this is changing the face of the world. Now, in terms of security, the old notion of the Leviathan demanding total power to ensure total security has flunked. It's not applicable anymore. In fact, one could argue that there is a fundamental contradiction between the new circumstances and the old state. Mainly the fact that even when We are now dealing with democratic leviathans. They are leviathans nevertheless. And that in the ultimate analysis, they behave as such. And that therefore, there is a tension between the tools that states have at hand to ensure security and the demands of the world on the one hand, these new threats that need to be faced multilaterally or with the cooperation of several states, not only one, and also with respect to the demands of the population that say, listen, remember, I'm here and I'm the sovereign. So it doesn't matter if we voted for you. It doesn't matter if I gave you the capacity to represent me as leader of my nation. I'm still your boss. And whatever I gave you, I can take away from you. And I don't necessarily want to wait 4 years to do so in the next election. And that circumstance is not a theoretical problem anymore. Look what's going on in Brazil this time. It's a very good example of that. And that can bring in a lot of problems dealing not with the nature of the state anymore, not even with the legality of the state, but with its legitimacy, which is even worse. Because here we're dealing with an altogether different issue. The nature of power as it is exercised by this institution we call the state. So, in saying this, and I wanted to bring this about because I think we have to talk about public security and we have to talk about human security, which is not necessarily the same thing, and we have to talk about the threats that we face that are multidimensional in the exercise and the use of force. And in doing so, we have to find ways in which to make the action of the state in order to assure security more effective. I mean, how do we do that? I mean, the old recipe was be tough. The new recipe seems to be different from that. I'm going to talk about that in a little while. Threats being multidimensional, in other words, the fact that we cannot point at one single reason for a phenomenon such as terrorism, organized crime. You have multiple factors in the origin of these maladies, of these tremendous, these horrible things, is one problem. But also the fact that in dealing with that, you need, you know, multidimensional instruments. It's not the question of the use of force anymore, or only the use of force anymore. And so we're talking here of not only structural factors that deal with insecurity, the economy, for example. We are also talking of cultural factors, like religion involved. And all of this does have an impact on security. And even when we have to be very careful not to criminalize poverty and find a relationship between higher degrees of insecurity associated with bigger degrees of poverty, this is not necessarily the case. For example, take two Central American countries, Nicaragua and Honduras. They're both poor by, you know, UN standards. Yet Honduras is much more violent than Nicaragua. So, you know, there's not such correlation. It's not possible. Or you can take a society like Costa Rica that's considered to be a high middle income society, and we like to think of ourselves as a democratic model and all of that. I'm not going to get into, you know, all the niceties of my country, but we are having a very serious problem with organized crime, even when our population is better off than some of the other populations of Central America. So it's very difficult to make correlations between poverty and criminal activities, illegal activities. But there is one that I would like to point at because it's one of those that points at the core of some of the problems we have and illustrates the multidimensional nature of some of these violent manifestations. If you take statistics relating to young men from 19 to 25 years of age, and you correlate that to the use of weapons, the degree of unemployment, and them living in very poor, deprived of recreational and economic conditions neighborhoods, then you will find that crime rates are heightened. So this is a very good case of the kinds of things that we have to deal with. And in understanding that issue, the other fact that has appeared is that whatever we used to consider legal factors of power, are now being challenged by what some people call, myself, factical power. It was always there. I mean, these are unduly powerful sectors of society, some of which are even armed, more armed than the legal ones. And this is clearly the case of terrorists, organizations, and this is clearly the case of some organized crime organizations. They have the monopoly on the use of force, which Hobbes so much talked about in the case of states, is no longer the sole duty of the state. State is being challenged militarily by these universities, by these forces. And so now let me turn to Central America, where all of this is concocting. And what I want is to bring these reflections to the Central American case, which is something that I'm very concerned about, and we all should be very concerned about because of how close it is to the United States, because we have a relationship that's very open, and because we're seeing new issues arising in the region that calls for more attention. And I'm glad that the U.S. and the Central American countries are cooperating in order to reduce these threats. On the one hand, we've seen Central America evolve from internal war to a new circumstance. One of the things that I keep on saying is that it is very unfair to say that Central America is as violent as it was, or more violent than what it was in the 1980s. Senator Kassebaum, who was so instrumental to bring about the peace plan with her colleagues in the Senate and in the House of Representatives of this country, knows that the nature of our violence today is very different from the nature of the violence in the past. In the 1970s and 80s, the Central American Leviathans, with the exception of Costa Rica, which was a democratic nation, were being terrorist states, were terrorist states that were attacking their own populations. And it took the world and almost a decade of efforts and millions of Central Americans dead to put an end to that. Today, the violence in Central America is associated with the organized crime. It's a completely different issue. Yes, the people are being killed, but the reason for the massacre of young people in Central America today is very different from the ones I saw in my own youth. So it's a different issue. But Central America has come out of that stage of its history into a more at least stable political situation in which all countries today have been elected. We have some doubts about, you know, this and that country, but they're elected governments. But the social conditions are still adamant. And in a sense, we haven't been able to solve those structural issues that in many ways justify or explain the violence in the region. And the geographical position I've mentioned, it's very important. Central America remains a very sensitive geopolitical region. And in the midst of that region, we have seen organized crime thrive. Now, I'd like to mention three characteristics of organized crime as we see it and we face it in Central America. The first of them is the use of force. And it has become a challenge to nation states in the region. The use of force is immense. Secondly, the capacity to corrupt democratic institutions. It's a very troubling issue because it attacks the legitimacy of the Central American governments. And thirdly, it's its capacity to absorb other forms of regular crime, ordinary crime, and turn that part of their operations. And it comes, organized crime comes in all of its forms, I've mentioned it. Drug trafficking is probably the most common of it, and it's the one we hear about all the time. But there are others, arms trafficking, human trafficking, cultural trafficking, etc. And obviously, it has a very serious effect on health issues, on political stability, economic growth. It's very expensive. Corruption is very, very expensive. And the capacity of states to improve the conditions, the general conditions of its population. Now, we've been combating organized crime for a quarter of a century now, 25 years at least, probably more. I mean, the first exercises took place in the 1970s. Now, massively, we have been investing in this, and the United States has done its part, clearly, for more than a quarter century. And we have not been successful in stopping that that flow of drugs. Now, this flow doesn't originate in Central America. It passes through Central America, from the Andean region, and mainly Colombia in what pertains cocaine, and then some other drugs from other countries as well. But paradoxically, the outcome of peace in Colombia is increasing the amounts of drugs being produced in the country, because the government is completely involved in the peace negotiations, which is great. I mean, we are very, very supportive of that process. But in having decided that this is the national priority, the way in which the Colombians were fighting the war on drugs, spraying plantations of coke and the other things that they did, have taken a backseat in public policy, and this is bringing in more cocaine into Central America. And we've been pretty successful in dealing with this, largely through joint operations on the sea, sea line, seafaring, because of a way in which cocaine was being transferred. But in doing so, we are now seeing that they're pushing the traffic inland. And not only that, but the old way of paying with money, the cocaine that was being brought through Central America, has been substituted by paying with drugs. And in doing so, the violence in the streets of Central America have increased significantly. Because now we have smaller lords, drug lords, that are fighting against each other all the time. So how to deal with this? I mean, some people are talking about legalization, for example. I don't think that that's a very good idea, myself. Not because we're being successful in dealing with the issue, because we have not, and clearly the militarization of the fight against drugs has not worked, but simply because the problem is not marijuana. And everybody seems to be willing to legalize marijuana, but the problem is not there. The problem is cocaine. And not many people want to legalize cocaine. It's a different issue. Okay? Pot? Okay. Cocaine? Not necessarily. So this is something that needs to be... I consider that we have to deal with, and I'm going to close with some ideas, we have to deal with this in a different manner. But anyway, the situation has been serious in terms of narco-trafficking. It has consumed a lot of effort, financial, military, security, human, without real success. Now, there's a second manifestation of organized crime that I would like to call your attention to, and that's the situation of migrants. We are seeing Central America now become a bridge for migrants, and largely two kinds of migrants. One group, which is still there, although we have been able to deal with it in a very humane and constructive way, but it is a significant population, is formed by Cubans, who are now capable of leaving their country with a legal passport into Ecuador, that receives them. They're now asking for visas and things. But there are over 40,000 Cubans out of Cuba that have been moving towards the United States because they are given special privileges, migration privilege in the United States under certain laws that were enacted during the Cold War. They want to come here, and if they are able to make it here, they cannot do it directly from Cuba. They have to walk around 8,000 kilometers from Ecuador to the United States walking. If they're able to make it to the border and they touch American soil, then they claim they're Cubans, they show their passport, and they are put into a program, and after a year they're given a residence in the United States, and later on they will be admitted as citizens. And we had 6,000 of them accumulated at once in Costa Rica just a few months ago. And Panama had the same problem. They came from Ecuador through Colombia into Panama, Costa Rica, and then they were stopped there by the Nicaraguan government, it was very difficult to deal with that situation. But at least they had a passport. We know who they were, where they came from, and where they wanted to go. The second group is what we call extracontinental migrants. These are people who come from Africa and from Asia and from the Middle East. And they're coming following the routes of human traffickers. These individuals, who are also part of a cohort of thousands, are now traveling through Latin America because their way of passage of old is now closed, which was the European route. They wanted to get to Germany, to France, and then they want to come to the United States and Canada. Now this group is again massing up in the Costa Rican-Panamanian borders, and they're being stopped by the Nicaraguan government. They're not being allowed to move north. And they're coming, you know, by the hundreds every day. Sometimes 100, 150, 50, you know, and they're coming up, and they're coming up, and they're massing up. And differently from the Cuban migration, this is a migration that we don't know where it comes from. We don't know who they are. They are not identified. They don't bear a passport. And even when we know they're coming to the United States, and this is where they want to come, we're not sure they're going to get here. And probably they're going to look for a place to stay along the way. And this situation has brought up a whole new circumstance in the region. We have a situation that needs to be handled from a humanitarian point of view, but there's no way we can do that because, one, the states in Central America are not capable of doing this. We don't have the resources necessary to hold populations of 5,000, 6,000, 7,000 people at once. This we have not seen since the 1980s. And secondly, there's no international framework, neither in Central America nor in Europe, to deal with that kind of new international problem. This is not being handled. They are not refugees. These are migrants. And in many cases, these are economic migrants, more in the case of the Cuban crowd than the extracontinental crowd. So, in closing, I would have to say that this new circumstances are putting a lot of stress in regional security, particularly when you have these crowds of people who, some of them are not even Christians in the sense that they have to receive a special treatment because they have different traditions, religious traditions, which we're, in the case of Costa Rica, we're trying to take care of. For example, we bring in the imams from the only mosque we have in San Jose to deal with 20% of that population that's Islamic, but who do not have also the other traditions, share the traditions, the Latin traditions that the Cuban crowd has. So if the whole condition of this migration is very peculiar because, you know, unless we want to create a very serious social issue within the country, we have to let them go. And clearly we're doing that. We are allowing them to come into the country. We process them in a detention center. The law says that we cannot hold them there for more than 30 days because they have committed no crime. They're not criminals. They just went away from their own home countries following the need to survive. In some cases, survive from war. In other cases, to survive from hunger. and they're in Costa Rica. So, you know, they cannot be held there. And so we free them, and what they do is they find somebody who was willing to take them north. And then we transfer the problem to the next country. And so they go up. And eventually they're going to reach the United States. But we don't know who they are. And we don't know who they where they come from. And this is a big concern for Homeland Security. Okay? Because these are the new challenges, okay? So, and this has not been, the Leviathan is not capable of dealing with these issues. So, in trying to find new ways to eliminate these threats, what is the international community doing, and what can we do about it? And I'm going to close with this. First of all, we have to understand this new conditions of security threats, and that these threats are growing. They're not reducing. They're not being reduced. They're growing, and that the dealing with these new issues is not something that states can do successfully all the time. In other words, we need more than the state. The Leviathan is not working. So this entails getting some other members of the community involved. And it is here where civil society, organized civil society, churches, the private sector play such an important role. We're calling the attention of these groups, you know, so that they can become part of the solution. We are very concerned about community work. So we have to get people involved so that they understand the depth of the challenge we face from the states. Secondly, we have to deal with the economic realities of these individuals. It is not possible to stop them if they have reasons to leave. And in fact, you know, there is a good case for considering migration a human right. What would you have said to your forefathers, the founding fathers of the Republic, when they wanted to leave England because of religious persecution, for example? Was that a right? Should have they been considered illegals, as we call them, because they decided to move away? Or my own experience, my family on my mother's side came from Jamaica. My great-grandmother was a black woman with five children from three marriages. She had widowed three times. And she came to Costa Rica in the early 20th century. Should have Mary Taylor been held in Jamaica because she didn't bear a passport when she came to Costa Rica? It's very complicated. So, you know, ensuring that we do things like complying with the sustainable development objectives, which is something that the United Nations is now calling for in its last session, is something that we ought to take very seriously, particularly in places like Africa and the Middle East. The whole question of war needs to be addressed. And probably we need to think about an organization that, just as the High Commissioner for Refugees, will deal with migrants. There's one organization that exists already, the International Migration Organization, IOM, that's not sufficient to deal with the current flows. They're very good bringing migrants back to their own home countries, but if the home country is in trouble, they're not going back. They don't want to go back, and we cannot force them to go back. So we have to think about these things. Pope Francis has been concerned about this very much. He helped us quite a bit with the Cuban situation, and I'm going to see him next week in Rome. And I think that one of the things I would like to talk with the Holy Father about is this. What can we do from an international point of view to deal with these migrant flows, which are a reality of our time, and they're not going to go away? And then the other thing is, if the challengers are multilateral, and if the reason for these challenges is not a single one, that they are multidimensional as well, how can we address that? I mean, let's think more beyond the military solution, which is not going to work. And this, again, deals with community networks. It deals with recreational opportunities. It deals with municipal governments getting involved, which is something very difficult to handle in Central America, where presidentialism in most countries is very, very strong. The deficits in human development and the quality of democracy needs to be addressed. And in social integration and cohesiveness of social institutions, this needs to be put forth, sometimes even before the use of force, which is important. I grant you that. You're dealing with a narco organization, you cannot deal with them only in very gentle terms. I mean, there has to be capacity of the police force to deal with that. Same thing with terrorism. I mean, I'm not calling for appeasement against the war against terrorism, but I'm saying that there are other things that need to be put in the debate. And the whole question of justice, how do we deal with the administration of justice and the fact that all the jails in many countries are full with people, while there are so many others that should be in jail and are not being jailed. I mean, this whole issue is something that I'm very concerned about as well. But I do believe that our role has to be more intense. All of ours, all of us, the role of all of us has to be more intense. And when I come to the United States and I hear the experience that you have here with the involvement of people in community affairs, I'm very, very happy. And sometimes I like to think that we may get to back to Latin America with more integrated communities. I would like, and I think that this is a very good idea to deal with crime, especially petty organized crime. The local crime that we're dealing with in Central America as a result of the new ways in which organized crime pay for the drug and all of that. More integrated societies. Yes, family values, yes, of course, very important. But beyond that, the capacity that we have to join and take over our communities again. And let me share with you in closing one exercise that we have just started. There's a barrio, there's a neighborhood, very poor neighborhood in the heart of San Jose called La Carpio. Carpio is the name of the guy who started this barrio. It was the last name of the guy. And it's one of the poorest neighborhoods in the country. 50% of it is formed by Nicaraguan migrants into Costa Rica, 50% is Costa Rica. And we've had problems with La Carpio, property rights, problems with people, unemployment, etc. And we decided that we were going to change the approach to deal with the situation in the barrio. And instead of putting more policemen in, we decided that we were going to get 26 families of the barrio, in the middle of the barrio, we were going to get 26 families out of there. And we found places for them to be, and they all live in houses that that do not belong to them. And the property is not theirs. The property is public, and they just, they've been there for years. So we gave them a new property somewhere else, and we decided to build a school for La Carpio. School and a high school in that property, in the middle of town. The impact that has had in the community is impressive. I'm not going to say that we are solving all the problems by building that, but the new community spirit, the new purpose that the people of La Carpio have found in having a new, wonderful, beautiful school is something to be analyzed. And I think that maybe some kinds of approaches like that, providing music to communities, giving them the possibility of their children to have safer places where to play, is part of the solution as well. At any rate, it's going to take a while, but I think if we are devoted and committed to democracy, we will be able to solve some of these issues. And in thinking of how to close these words, these reflections, I found a quote by Victor Hugo, the French writer. And he was talking on this particular piece about the future. And he said, well, what does the future mean? And he said, well, it means different things to different people. For the weak, the future is the impossible. For the faint-hearted, the future is the unknown. But for the valiant, the future is an opportunity. I don't know if we are the future or not, but clearly we are responsible for trying to achieve a future for opportunity to all. I thank you very much.
You're listening to the President of Costa Rica, Luis Guillermo Solis. President Solis spoke at the Kansas State Landon Lecture Series on May 19, 2016. Solis now takes a couple of questions from the audience before responding to both of them. A reminder that President Solis spoke at Kansas State University prior to this week's British vote on whether or not to remain in the European Union. I'm Kay McIntyre. You're listening to KPR Presents on Kansas Public Radio.
You talked about sovereignty of nations and how barriers are really changing because we are so interconnected. Is it fair to ask you to look at what's happening with the EU right now and one of those nations wanting to come out and destabilizing the entire unit? I really was struck by your words about national sovereignty.
Mm-hmm. Sure. Absolutely.
Other questions, if you would come forward.
I was wondering what you think about the amount of personal responsibility a citizen of a country has to stay in that country and improve it. If a Costa Rican citizen should pursue maybe an opportunity for a better life in America, or if it's their duty to stay in Costa Rica and improve that country, and just not only Costa Ricans, but a citizen of any country. Thank you.
Sure. Clearly, the European Union is facing a huge problem on the question of integration. They have the most developed integrated model in the world. No region at no point in history has had the level of integration that they've reached, other than empires, which obviously are not models of integration, but a forceful submission, which is a different thing altogether. I think that it is very complicated for the United for Europe to be challenged by well, actually, I think when is it that the Great Britain is going to? I think they're voting next weekend, if they stay or not in the European Union. The problem of integrated systems is that they are as weak as the weakest link in the chain, and so you can have very committed countries that, if you have one or two that are failing, then it's not going to work. And the European Union has been moving very fast in its integration with a number of very important agreements, including monetary agreements, Schengen, dealing with migrations, and so on and so forth. And now to undo those agreements could have very serious institutional and political consequences. So the only way they can escape from integration is moving forward, in my opinion, not going backwards. I mean, if the European Union starts undeveloping, instead of evolving, going backwards to the idea of breaking apart, I fear that the consequences are going to be extremely serious for the system. Because now, you know, the larger part of Europe has become integrated in total. I mean, we're talking here of a system where parliamentary discussions are now obligatory. How do you call it? It's our mandates that they have to take on the basis of their own internal laws. So that's my fear, and I do hope that Britain will stay a member of the European Union. Now, let me say this, because the position of Costa Rica vis-a-vis the regional Central American integration is very similar to Britain. That's not assured. They could come out. And even when Great Britain is not part of the monetary union, and even when they have, you know, they have kept many of their own, so they're a marginal part of the integration system, their political and economic weight is such that it can have a very serious impact. The second question on personal responsibility, stay or not to stay. My experience in dealing with, you know, migrations everywhere is that people tend to stay if in the, in their own countries if they have the opportunity to do so. I mean, if even if the conditions are not as good in terms of how much money they can make, if they can, if we can provide the sufficient conditions for them to stay without being threatened and without having problems of hunger and health issues, etc., they will definitely stay. They are not going to go away. Some people go away, obviously, because those who go away are the more aggressive, the people who have more initiative. And if you make an analysis of who are the people who go, they are probably the more willing to be challenged and to survive and to move forward. Just think what it takes for a Cuban, and we're talking of a very specific kind of migrant, because they are documented and they have conditions of education in Cuba and also legal conditions if they arrive to the United States. But just think of this: they have to, living in an island that's only 190 miles away from the United States. Because of American law, they have to travel to Ecuador and walk from Ecuador to the United States 8,000 kilometers. That's twice the size of the border of the United States with Mexico. They have to, it would be like walking across Mexico to the end of that border and then back. That's as how much they have to work. So I'm pretty clear that if they have the conditions, they don't go. Look what happens with Costa Ricans. Yes, we have, you know, several thousand Costa Ricans abroad. Some of them are here. They've lived in the United States for a number of years, and they're very happy to be here. But they have not. By and far, our migration is a fraction of the migration of other Central American countries, and obviously the case in point is El Salvador, where several million Salvadorans have traveled to other countries, including Costa Rica, for personal safety reasons and economic reasons.
Would you join me in thanking President Solis for his wonderful comments?
You've just heard the President of Costa Rica, Luis Guillermo Solis. President Solis spoke at Kansas State Land and Lecture Series on May 19, 2016. Thanks to Kansas State University for audio of this event. I'm Kay McIntyre. KPR Presents is a production of Kansas Public Radio at the University of Kansas. Did you know that most KPR Presents programs are archived on our website? So if you missed recent shows featuring other Landon lectures, like John Avlon and Margaret Hoover talking about political moderates and how they hold the key to politics, or historian H.W. Brands talking about the legacy of President Ronald Reagan, you can listen to them anytime at kpr.ku.edu. There you'll also find recent programs featuring speakers from the Dole Institute of Politics at the University of Kansas and locally produced programs like our panel of political reporters previewing the special session of the Kansas Legislature. Go to our website, kpr.ku.edu, look under News, and then KPR Presents. You can also find music recorded in KPR's live performance studio, a complete program schedule for KPR and KPR2, and listen online. It's all at kpr.ku.edu.